This podcast is part of the Deluxe Edition Network. To find other great shows on the network, head over to deluxeeditionnetwork.com. That's deluxeeditionnetwork.com.
The podcast making, public transit taking, kiss stealing, wheeling, dealing, son of a gun, Tim the Nerd, welcoming you to another episode of Friends Talking Nerdy, part of the Deluxe Edition Network. Head to deluxeeditionnetwork.com to find out more information about all the wonderful shows on the Gen Network. And sitting next to me, after an exhausting night of teaching and with a belly full of frozen pizza, we have the greatest legal mind in the Pacific Northwest. And if you hear some voltage-type sounds in the background, that is also Professor Aubrey. How you doing?
Yes. Hello. I am, as Tim hinted, am sitting here on my exercise ball with my brand new TENS unit in my lower back area, sending electrical shocks through my lumbar spine.
So if you hear her do this every now and then, it is that, and just that.
It feels so good. And then when it's done, it's very numb. So like if you have pain in that area, it's totally pain relieving, but it also is causing the muscles to contract and then relax. So it contracts them really hard, like you're working them really hard, like picking up something really heavy, but then it lets go.
I felt it. I mean, you put it on me yesterday, and you had one of the higher settings on there, and that was, pardon the pun, a jolt.
Ow.
Yeah, because like part of it was like it was going on, and it was just like, oh my god, Aubrey, oh my god, please stop it, stop.
Yeah, it's one of those times that it becomes useful to be a talker.
Yeah, instead of a rambling bastard like me. But I will say that after my experience with it, you know, even though my back wasn't, you know, giving me too much, where you were just doing it for demonstration purposes, afterwards it did feel like, oh.
Oh, yeah, I think it really does work.
Yeah.
I first had it at the first chiropractor I went to here in Portland, and I was like, really? That's possible? And it's only recently that they've been, in the last 5 years, I guess, become available without a prescription.
Yeah, lucky for all the people that like to use it for other purposes, too.
Yeah, they used to be much harder to find.
Yeah, anyway, you didn't want to go down that road. But you would definitely recommend this for, you know, us folks once you reach a certain age that will have normal aches and pains throughout the day, no matter what.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you got it on Amazon, right?
I did get it on Amazon.
Mm-hmm. What was the cost?
$31.
Look at that, folks. $31 yeah. For some tremendous relief.
I mean, really, for $31, it feels just like it does in the chiropractor's office. I don't know if it's going to last a long time. I don't know if there was child labor involved, but
I laugh, but I should know. I mean, it's, you know, most everything, I guess, that we value today that we purchase and use, like the wonderful MacBook Pro here, is made in countries with very loose labor laws.
Yeah, very loose.
Yeah. And
so what basically happens, I don't know if you know this, but every major corporation that manufactures things in China or other places where the working conditions are questionable, or the labor practices are questionable. In those places, if the manufacturers, like our U.S. companies, they will only hire factories that meet certain standards. And then they get qualified as like a socially responsible company. And those facilities, even though they could operate in a much different way under the governmental regulations, operate in a better way because of the intervention of these corporations. So it's like, is it really, they can still make things for pennies on the dollar in China compared to manufacturing in the US. So even if they have to increase safety or whatever, and it costs, you know, $50,000 or whatever, that's still just pennies on the dollar for all of the consumer goods, particularly high-end consumer goods, which are manufactured in the same place that other goods are manufactured.
Capitalism sucks in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, I mean, I do say this acknowledging the fact that, you know, we are recording a show on a MacBook Pro, so it's not like we're living, you know, recording this show live from a box on the side of the road. You know, it's still dirty, dirty, dirty what they do, because, I mean, look what's happening in Portland with, you know, places like Target pulling out, claiming it's because of crime, even though there are people that came out afterwards showing that instances of crime in the store that they closed down in downtown Portland were far, far less than they were in another store that remained open. It's just businesses know that they can put a black eye on things by stating, we're not safe. And all of a sudden government will, you know, start letting their guys with batons go nuts again.
Yeah. Yeah. Against the most vulnerable. Like we're getting away from that moment. It's just like September 11th. The more and more I think about it, I think that the pandemic was the same kind of group trauma as 9/11, and that will follow this sort of similar pattern where right after it, everybody was super sweet to each other and kind and helpful. And then like the emergency passes and people just forget all about it in terms of how compelled they felt to do things in response to volunteer or to raise money or...
Well, it didn't help, too, that was the start of the ball rolling towards, you know, what we face today. And, you know, because look at all of the pressure campaigns the Bush, you know, administration put out of, you know, how dare you question what we do? Are you supporting the terrorist? I mean, the reason Keith Olbermann, for instance, ended up becoming a big thing on MSNBC was he was the only person there that had anything negative to say about Bush. On MSNBC. Oh, and it's we're down a pretty dangerous path here, and we'll go over politics here a little bit later. I mean, we normally try to steer clear from it, but this, you know, 2024 being the election year that it is, we are bound to have some talk about this. We would be fools not to.
Yeah.
Yep. But first, we do want to have some good news and bad news. Do you want to start off with the good news or bad news?
Let's start off with the bad news.
Okay, you deliver that bad news.
So the bad news is that we have teachers on strike here in Portland. And that's bad news because it means that the school board is not giving them a fair contract. And they're having to go out of work in order to demonstrate that their labor is valuable. It has thrown the city into a mess. Like, it feels like the same kind of emergency when COVID first started and everybody had their kids and had no idea what they were going to do with them. And the, you know, the little kids, people with little kids, like, what are they supposed to do? Single parents, what are they supposed to do? Like,
that is... I mean, the unfortunate part of the job, but the teachers have to be able to use the power that they do have, and that's the power to strike, to be able to make their point that they're not happy with the conditions, but we are talking bad news here.
Well, I mean, the bad news is just that they continue to negotiate and are not reaching a deal. And so every day that goes by at this point, I think the tables are turning in public opinion. And even though people support the union,
once it affects them,
Once it affects them in their pocketbook and their ability to do social things and their ability, you know what I'm saying? Like, it hits them in a really personal way. And then it's going to be, they're going to turn on the teachers.
I mean, this is America. I would love to be idealistic, folks, but I'm 47. I've seen more than enough evidence that the professor is right. You know, that we've had plenty of situations in this country to where we've had trauma, whether it be local, regional, state, you know, national, worldwide, that we've all experienced. We've all come together, have a great big hug, and then a week later forgot about it. I mean, when it comes to this strike here, it is unfortunate that the teachers have, by using their power to strike, are negatively affecting, you know, parents out there. Because yes, you can have, you know, a single parent out there that fully supports the strike happening, but if they're the single parent and they're the sole breadwinner, you know, they have to worry about another expense suddenly because of, you know, daycare or, you know, getting a babysitter, depending on the kid's age, or maybe missing work, period, which could lead to further ramifications down the road.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you saw on the news about the interrogation in Congress of the guy from JP Morgan Chase, I think. And the representative asked, okay, there's a teller that works at your bank full time and she's a single parent and here's her budget. Here are the things she has to pay for.
Sounds like a Katie Porter question.
Yes, it was Katie Porter. Mm-hmm. So here's her budget, right? And she was like, this is the least she could get healthcare. This is the least she could get rent. You know, this is the very bottom of what's available. And, you know, just goes down this long list. And she's $650 in the hole every month without having purchased food, without having purchased medication. That, you know, she's just paying the rent and the utilities, basically. And so then an extra expense or a day off work. If she doesn't have sufficient sick time or they don't have sufficient sick time, like, yeah, I mean, it's impactful. Mm. And I think that people need to realize that teachers know that and they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't do it to their students.
Yeah, I mean, because think about it. Think about it logically. I mean, it's like the argument that people made against, you know, heavy metal in the 80s. And, you know, in terms of like, they're sending messages from the devil to the kids with backmasking and all that. And Ozzy Osbourne was like, why would we make music to kill our audience? You know, so why would a teacher not want to teach?
Yeah.
You know, that's why, you know, you have to sit back and sit up and listen. Now, at the end of the day, when it comes to something like the single parent, I can look the other way there. Like I look the other way at people, you know, that have, that are low income and shop at Walmart for groceries. Cause I've done that, you know, and you did, I do it with like a you feeling, but you do it.
You do it because you can walk out of Walmart with a cart overflowing with items, you know, food and whatever, for the same cost as like four bags at New Seasons.
But you are paying more in taxes to help supplement the so those welfare that the employees of that Walmart have to go on because that company is not paying them enough.
Well, I'm paying much more for the taxes that Walmart's not paying.
That's what I meant, yeah.
No. Oh. So you're saying the workers themselves are not paying taxes.
And you're talking as a corporation.
As a corporation, they get tax breaks.
I get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they get the tax breaks, but then those tax breaks and end up losing cities millions upon millions of dollars. Again, because a lot of these employees are having to go on welfare. And I'm sorry. I will not listen to anybody that tries to tell me that a person working at a job for 40 hours a week shouldn't make enough to barely get by. Have enough for a roof over their head, food in their belly, you know, clothes on their back.
It's a vicious society that says to people, we're going to give you opportunity to work, and you're going to work full time, and we're not going to pay you enough to live. So you're going to have to get a second job. And so you're going to be working 60 hours a week with no overtime, without benefits associated, like sick time and accrued PTO associated with that second job. So like a bunch of things you lose, even if you're making that additional, the same amount of money with your, if you were doing like the same base salary.
Yeah.
In a place where you get overtime versus having two shitty jobs where you don't get overtime in either. Yeah, they're a real terrible employer, but I shopped there when I lived in Kentucky, and it was the only place to shop in town. And there was just, I'd have to drive 45 minutes to go to a grocery store if I didn't go to the Walmart.
I mean, and the analogy I was trying to make here is that, you know, a single parent who is going to be struggling really hard by not having their kid in school, I can look the other way if their initial interest is going to be, you know, getting my kid back to school.
Mm-hmm.
Been there. And it's great to be ideological, but I think it's one thing to keep in mind too, that, you know, not everybody that would be upfront in terms of this strike needs to stop is necessarily trying to say that teachers shouldn't have their voice. They shouldn't have the power to be able to negotiate a fair contract. But, you know, look at me trying to find a positive out of something, but I think it's important to keep that in mind.
Yeah.
Yeah, but
I think so.
Anything else about
the I mean, I think it's a big time for labor. I mean, there's just labor stuff going on all over the place. People are winning really great contracts, and we had another one this week.
Yes, SAG after the actor strike is, as we record, pretty much over. Similar to the writer strike, when you have negotiations like this between a company, the negotiators will, you know, be the first ones to say, this is something we agree upon. And then they present it to the union to get voted on. And that is the process that is happening right now. But the heads of SAG-AFTRA have been out in the interviews stating that, you know, the actors are going to be looking at a nice bump in pay, because again, one thing to keep in mind about Hollywood, it is our biggest, entertainment is our biggest export, and not every actor is making Tom Cruise money. Most actors in Hollywood are, you know,
giggers.
That, or if they're somewhat working regularly, they could be making, like, you know, a solid, you know, upper five figures. And a lot of people are going to be happy doing that, you know, playing toy soldier in front of cameras. You know, like, hey, Tim, would you want to work on this military TV show for $70,000 a year? Let's see. You know,
yeah, I mean, gotcha. Point taken.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody's a millionaire.
That's right. Finally proved my point.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a hallmark of our era that there's such a disparity between the rich and the poor. So
yeah, most importantly, with this strike, though, they did get protections with artificial intelligence. You know, the studios at one point were asking, they even dumped their previous thing about stating that they wanted to hire like relatively unknown actors and pay them $200 to do a complete 3D scan. And then they would have control of that 3D scan for perpetuity.
Mm-hmm.
They went from that to stating, we just want to hire people and do their scan and not tell them about it, you know, and not pay them. But that got figured out. You know, there is protection for the actors in this particular case. And I know that that was one of the big sticking points that kind of started the ball rolling here. But if all goes well and the actors union votes, which more than likely they will, I don't
think they want to be on strike anymore.
That And also, like, if, you know, you are supportive of this union in the first place, you're not going to be, you know, saying no to the people that, you know, you voted into place to, you know, do these negotiations. I mean, I'm sure
you might. I mean, yeah. You might, like, as a person who's on a bargaining committee, you're never going to make everybody happy. So there's always going to be a faction that's going to be unhappy. The only question is, are they going to be a big enough faction to defeat the 2/3 majority vote that's required to ratify an agreement?
Wow, you know what politics like that reminds me of?
What? Wrestling?
Professional wrestling. I saw a great documentary I wanted to talk a few minutes about here on the show in a very loving way because I thought it was quite beautiful.
Nice.
Yeah. Oh,
tell me about it.
All right. It is on the cock, Peacock, part of their WWE section, and it is called Superfan, The Story of Vlad. And who is Vlad? If you are, like me, a longtime fan of professional wrestling, if you notice, you know, after certain points in time, there may be some faces in the crowd that show up on a regular basis just because they're able to get tickets to, you know, the particular shows that are going to have, like, TV tapings or pay-per-view or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And one such guy was Vlad. He primarily would show up at, like, Madison Square Garden shows, but, you know, he'd always be in the front row, have a huge smile on his face, and screaming at everybody. But, I mean, he would be screaming at the bad guys, but he'd have the biggest smile on his face. Some of the early episodes of Monday Night Raw, including the first episode, he was in the front row cheering along with everybody else. And he's one of those faces that, you know, for people like me, you've seen him enough to where you hear stories about him. And, you know, initially I thought he was Russian, but apparently he's Haitian.
Oh.
There were rumors that, you know, the reason he got to be at so many big shows like that was, I mean, he was a bodybuilder himself, and people thought that he was, like, Vince McMahon's personal trainer, and, like, part of the perks of the job was being able to sit in the front row for WWE shows, and, I mean, that would be a great perk.
Wow, and people believed it.
They did, but the documentary just pointed out that, you know, he was a Haitian immigrant, lived with his mother for all of his life, and it sounds like it was just a very simple guy. Just wanted to be able to pay enough to have a roof over his head to take care of his mother and to go see wrestling when it came to town.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, it went all the way back. Like, his first big time thing that he got noticed for was in 86. There was a show at Madison Square Garden that they filmed, and they had a live Piper's Pit with Roddy Piper, and Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff came out with his manager, Bobby the Brain Heenan, and wanted to know about facing Roddy Piper in a tag team match later that night. And Roddy ended up pulling Vlad out of the audience, asking him who his tag team partner should be. And he was like, Hulk Hogan! And, you know, and everybody went nuts at that particular point. But the documentary went into some pretty emotional stuff, too, because it talked about, you know, the fact that, again, lived with his mother for all his life. And when COVID hit, she was in her 90s and took a fall and had to be put in a home, and it got COVID. Mm. And she passed away. Yeah, so Vlad was devastated, of course. I mean, lived with her his entire life. That would be just as much of a shock as, you know, like two married people living together for 70 years, you know, when one of them goes. And he talked about during the time of COVID, when he was not able to go see wrestling, he was suicidal.
Mm.
And he attempted, but he got help. And the WWE did a real beautiful thing. Like when they started allowing fans back into the arena at WrestleMania 37, I think that was in 2021. WWE sent him a video with, like, some, you know, a number of, like, legendary wrestlers who had interacted with Vlad over the years,
mm-hmm.
you know, telling him, you know, hey, you're hearing about your story, hope to see you again soon, blah, blah, blah. And then at the end, it was revealed that they were going to bring him to WrestleMania and have him in the front row. And they brought him, it was at Tampa Bay that year. They brought him there. He was backstage meeting a lot of people. Triple H and Stephanie McMahon arrive, pull him aside, and they give him a plaque as the official first ever WWE superfan.
Wow.
And the documentary ended with him just enjoying his time at WrestleMania.
Yeah, that is such a sweet story.
Yeah, and I know the cynic in me always, you know, thinks of, you know, what other people would say. And I know there may be people out there that may think that might be a little sad. But this is what made this guy happy. It's like, I don't know him personally, so I can't speak for him. But from the sound of it, it just sounds like he's just a very simple guy. Just one of those guys that just love to punch the time clock, do his job, come home, and, you know, be happy. And if professional wrestling is what made him happy and is, you know, what got him friends in the business, got him some great memorabilia, like he has a flag with Hulk Hogan's blood on it from, I think, WrestleMania 7.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, I say, what better story is there than that? He's lived his fantasy of just being there in the crowd and being the best fan he can be.
Yeah, that's a really great story. Yeah, I think you're right that people might think that that's sad. But I agree with you that it's not sad. And I, you know, I think people ought not judge what makes other people happy.
Exactly.
You know, it's up to them. Great documentary. You should check it out.
Yes, yeah, super fan on the cock. Now, before we get to our main event here, we do want to talk about politics a little bit, because as we record this, we are past off-season elections that showed that had some pretty great results for progressive causes. Like Ohio, in a Republican state, passed a constitutional amendment to their state constitution protecting the right to abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Virginia, their House and Senate split to Democrat, embarrassing the Republican governor there. And the funny thing is, a lot of people in Republican circles wanted this guy, this Glenn Youngkin, that's his name. They were hoping that he would come in into the presidency at the last minute and you know, try and be the responsible one. But with this happening, Ohio legalized recreational marijuana.
That's awesome.
Yeah, which...
I wonder how they'll do it. You know, I think it's interesting that early states have done it differently from each other, and I'm sure there's lots of policy studies of what the best policies are based on...
Yeah, I mean, this is the 24th state, so I used to say 10 years, now I'm going to say 5 years. It would shock me if it is not legalized recreationally nationally within 5 years.
Yeah, I mean...
If almost half the states are like, this should not be illegal, and it makes more sense to tax it and, you know, regulate it so we can make sure that the appropriate people who are age appropriate to use it get it.
And that it's safe and not adulterated.
And that is another thing to think about, too. If it does become like decriminalized or whatever they do to make it, you know, okay to sell weed legally, it would make it to where there would be standardized ways to, you know, harvest the weed to do what they need to do. Because now it's just state by state and rule by rule wherever they're at.
Yeah.
Anyway, and this comes, this election does come on the tails of some poll numbers that showed that Biden was behind of Trump in some swing states, and people online were freaking out a little bit about that. Even though if you have a very cursory knowledge of presidential election history, you will know that most previous presidents at the, you know, year before the end of their first term didn't have the best of numbers until election time again.
Right, because I think part of it is that they can't start campaigning. Mm. They have to govern. So they start campaigning much later.
And I think, you know, especially with this election that we just had here as we record, I think the one thing that is freaking Republicans out is just how mobilized Democrats have become. I mean, I think there are a number of people in our position, because I think we can, I can speak for you safely by stating that if there were an alternate to Joe Biden in the Democratic Party that could take on Donald Trump and beat him, I would be all for that, especially a much younger one. But if Joe Biden's name is on the ballot in November 24, I'm voting for him. And I think a number of Democrats And a number of just citizens in this country are going to make sure that is happening just to get through, cross fingers, this Trump stuff.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's what we thought in 2016.
Look at 2020. Look at 2022. Look at this election here. I look at 2018 as well. Ever the last time Republicans had any major huge wins was in 2016. And is progress going as fast as I would like? By no means. By no means. But I do think that, to me, you know me enough. I mean, I'm just, you know, paranoid and scared about everything. To me, I am actually a little bit comforted by, you know, seeing what's happening in the election results, because people shouldn't really focus on polls, because polls don't matter. Elections do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if it's a year out, and if you think Joe Biden's numbers are not as good as they should be, because right now, he's the best shot. You know, if his numbers are not where you think they should be, you got to get out there and do something.
Mm-hmm. Good lesson for us. We got to get out there and do something.
Exactly. Exactly. So enough pontificating there. How about we send it to one of our good friends at the Deluxe Edition Network to let you folks know about their show?
I think we should do that.
All right. Pay attention to this spot.
Hey, this is Casey Shearer.
And this is Ray.
Do you like pop culture?
We're pretty sure you do.
Then come on over and check us out at deluxeedition.show.
You will not be sorry. Or maybe you will be. I don't know.
When was the first time you became aware of the Beatles?
Oh, as early as I was aware of music, I'm sure one of the first things that I heard. My parents loved the Beatles, I think, growing up. They were both born in 1950, so we're 13 when the British invasion happened, so just the right age to be, you know, screaming teenagers. And so they had two compilation greatest hits albums, the Red Album and the Blue Album. And so we listened to those all the time for, you know, decades.
I mean, they definitely did set the standard for what makes a good greatest hits collection.
Oh, yeah.
Because especially in that era, there weren't that many good greatest hits collections. They would have like one or two of the hits, and then they would have a bunch of live songs. You know?
Oh, like they didn't want to give you the good songs. They wanted you to buy the albums that the good songs were on.
Yeah, it was a business decision. So, you know, we can thank streaming for that, or Napster or whatever, you know. And that does remind me, I think I've talked about it before, but there's another documentary we should watch, All Things Must Pass, about the rise and fall of Tower Records. As far as me, when it comes to the Beatles, like, yeah, my mother was a fan growing up. So, like, I was aware of them. Like, in the 80s, like, my mother would always cheer up every time the Ringo Starr Seagram's wine cooler commercials came on the air, because it was Ringo.
Yeah, that's cute.
Yeah. You know, I guess.
Was Ringo her favorite?
No, George.
George. George was her good favorite. Taste.
Yeah, and speaking of...
They've all been my favorite at some point.
Yeah. Speaking of George, though, he was, I think, probably my introduction to the Beatles, and that's because of Got My Mind Set on You, 1988, from the Cloud Nine album.
Yeah.
I thought he wrote that one at first, but found out later it was a cover of a 60s R&B song. And I know Warren Zevon did a cover of a 60s R&B song, and there are a number of great R&B songs from the 60s that are done by artists that should be talked about more, but you know what I'm saying. Great album there. It's a pontificating night here, folks.
Yeah, we were talking about the Beatles, man, and you ask me, was the first time I remember noticing the Beatles or being aware of the Beatles? Uh-huh. And I said, I can't really tell, but it was probably when I was very young, because we had those albums.
And like I mentioned, for me, it would be George Harrison with, you know, the Cloud Nine album and the Traveling Wilburys, who...
Absolutely. Yeah. Love the Traveling Wilburys. I thought it was some of the best music coming out at the time.
Yeah, and it was because of the Traveling Wilburys that we ended up getting the gift that was the songs that came with the Beatles anthology albums in the 90s. The Beatles came out with this three-day event that was done on ABC, and they had three albums that they released in three successive months of, you know, detailing the history of the band. And in the first two episodes of the documentary, at the end of the episode, they debuted a brand new Beatles song, Free as a Bird, for the first episode, which was on the first anthology album, and Real Love, which was on the second episode and the second anthology album. It was an idea that George Harrison brought to the table because of something they wanted to do with the Traveling Wilburys. They wanted Elvis as a Wilbury.
Oh my goodness.
They wanted to get some vocals from Elvis so they can all sing a song with Elvis Presley. And once again, Colonel Tom Parker, being the piece of shit that he was, helped put a stop to that, is my understanding.
Well, interestingly, one thing I've learned since the new song has come out.
I was getting there.
I know, but one thing
I'm impatient.
Well, no, it's related to what you're just saying. Yeah. Back in 1995, when Ringo, Paul, and George had gotten together to work on the other John Lennon demos on that cassette, which they did in the 90s without John. They didn't have John's vocals and John playing the piano. They didn't have any of that. They just finished orchestrating his songs and had musicians playing on it.
No, it was the same process for those two songs as it was for the one that just came out. So it was, and the three songs, I mean, Now and Then, the new song, was originally supposed to be on the third anthology episode. But as we know now, what happened is how John Lennon recorded it. With his demo. Now, musicians can vary in how they do demos. You can have a musician like John Lennon who was... Go ahead.
I'm going to take issue with you saying that I was wrong about how they made those albums in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Because those albums in the 90s were not made with the same kind of recording that Now and Then was on. Because the problem with Now and Then was that the vocal was too quiet and the piano was too loud. But it was one track because it was just on a cassette player.
Yeah, all three of those songs were on the same cassette.
So why is this groundbreaking technology?
Because what happened was this, as was explained in the documentary, thanks to a computer program that the folks with Peter Jackson's team came up with and developed during the course of the Get Back documentary, that allowed them to separate vocals from the music itself. They were able to separate John Lennon's vocals from that cassette tape from the piano using artificial intelligence. Now, when the first, you know, signs of this song hit and people heard artificial intelligence, they just thought of, like, I mean, because there are plenty of, like, do-it-yourself AI voice websites you can go to now to where a celebrity can do any type of thing that you say, but it sounds like that celebrity's, like, drunk when they're talking.
Yeah.
You know, so it was not like that. The AI in question, through machine learning, was, again, able to differentiate between Lennon's vocals and the piano and separate them, which was not able to be done in 94 when this is being recorded.
So my question remains, why didn't they finish it in 1995?
Because, like I said, they didn't have the technology at the time to split the vocal from the piano track.
So then how did they do it for the two that preceded? You're telling me they did it the same way, and then you're telling me they didn't have the technology to do it.
But that doesn't mean Lennon was playing a piano for those either. I mean, I think it was a guitar or whatever, and the vocals that they did use for those particular recordings just were more appropriate for use, which makes a lot of sense. If it was a small little cassette recorder that, you know, he had in his den that may have different acoustics compared to his office that may have different acoustics, I can understand to where, you know, in one room, a recording of a voice is going to sound much different than compared to another room. And, you know, I would also contend, too, that a piano is generally going to be somewhat louder than a guitar.
Oh, definitely.
Yes.
Piano is one of the loudest instruments there is.
Mm-hmm.
Can be. What the new song has done for me is that it has really made me think about them as individual artists in a way that I haven't really in the past. You know, it was just like the Beatles, and the sound was kind of just the Beatles sound. Like, I wasn't listening to it and saying, oh, wow, George's riff there is great. Or, oh, wow, listen to that bass. Paul's really tying one on,
yeah,
or whatever. But this, because I knew that that vocal track was separated out, and I knew that was John Lennon's voice, like his voice.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me really appreciate like his part and all the other parts and listen for them individually. So I've listened to this song over and over again, listening to different parts of it. And I just think the more I've listened to it, the more I think it is just a really good Beatles song.
I agree. And it's reminiscent of a lot of their late era songs. What do I mean by that? A lot of times in their later era, after Sgt. Pepper, they were less focused on the single than they were on just making a song that fit, you know, the mood of the album that they were doing. And let's face it, Paul McCartney's 81, Ringo Starr's 83. I don't think there's, I don't think I am mistaken in thinking of this as a, I mean, they're calling it the last Beatles song for a reason. This is a finale. You know, this is the song that will be played in the Beatles biopic in the end credits as it does a montage of the entire history of the band.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now, can there be constructive criticism that can be said for the quality of this song? Sure, you can. You know, you can talk, I mean, because I notice, you know, the difference in quality of Lennon's vocals from 78 compared to, you know, like Harrison's guitar part from the 90s and McCartney singing now. You can tell the difference.
Oh, gosh, you can tell the difference with McCartney singing now for sure.
Yeah, it's just to me, what is the important part here is this, is the spirit of closing. This is McCartney saying goodbye.
I mean, and Ringo. And let's not leave Ringo out.
Oh, yeah. Peace and love.
Ringo.
I mean, this is like so beautifully done that it wouldn't shock me to find out that you find out like Paul has like cancer or something, and which I hope is not the case. And I hope I'm just being extremely overdramatic here, but this is just a perfect way to close things. Now, would this... Does this sound, the song as it sounds today, be what the end result would have been if John Lennon were alive to complete it? Of course not. It, you know, especially during that era, Lennon was less on, you know, like strings anyway, for the songs that ended up on Double Fantasy. But that doesn't mean he didn't like him. Obviously, he had plenty of work in his solo career as well as with the Beatles. But this is more of his mellow, just basic rock phase when he wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing about his demos too, like I was trying to mention, like he was not a perfectionist with his demos. Like Pete Townsend, for instance, when he made a demo of a song, it was almost perfect and almost ready to just be put out the way he did it at home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like in Who Are You, for instance, in the middle when you have that acoustic guitar playing just out of nowhere, that's from Pete's demo. But again, like I mentioned with Lennon, he was just, you know, grab the first instrument, grab a cassette recorder, turn it on, sing into it, because it was just about getting essentially the idea on paper, the idea on tape, and then he would go into the studio and work from there. You know, which too, like I with the anthology, you can hear the Lennon's demos for Strawberry Fields Forever, and vocally in the demos sounds a lot like Now and Then. I mean, he just wasn't as evocative vocally, but in this case, though, like, It still works. It works. And I think for me, too, I think what makes it work is the harmony between Lennon and McCartney. I mean, last time we're going to hear it here. But just what a beautiful, beautiful way to end things, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that got me thinking, about parasocial relationships.
How did you make that leap?
Yes. I believe it was on the show Substack that I wrote this. But, you know, we've always kind of talked around this, but I didn't know what the term was. Like the biggest example would be my birthday episode, my 45th birthday when we were in Seattle, just trying to, you know, explain why it was weird having these feelings for, you know, Kurt Cobain passing when I didn't know the guy. And that's because it's a paranormal, the parasocial.
parasocial. Kurt
Cobain. Yeah. They'll see who the real villain is, kids. Yeah, anyway. parasocial relationships. And, you know, there are bad instances. I mean, there are real life versions of the book Misery, folks.
Yep.
You know, there are fans that take it too far. Like with Lennon. But we have all had a famous person that we've, you know, for lack of a better term, idolized. We've all had, you know, a fictional character at some point that, you know, we wanted to be in certain circumstances. You know, think about in the 60s, the many women who saw Nichelle Nichols as Uhura on Star Trek and used that to be inspired to get into science and join NASA.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think of all the times we've had fun on the show with parasocial relationships, like me with professional wrestling. You know, like I was angry at Andre the Giant for a while, folks. I mean, I was younger and that's what the business meant to do at the time. And now that I know how the magic's done, I can appreciate it more and not get as emotionally invested. But it's a parasocial relationship. I mean, do you have any memorable parasocial relationships?
I mean,
Dylan.
Yeah. Dylan was a character in my life for sure. Still is, really. And someone that I turned to for wisdom. And I have, you know, I've had the book of all Bob Dylan's lyrics through
85, I think.
85.
Yeah. Turn to the book of Dylan, chapter 12.
Yeah, no, that's what it was like. I mean, I used to carry it around with me for years and years and years. And now it just sits on my bookcase and I hardly ever open it. But yeah, like Dylan, who else?
Cyndi Lauper, maybe? No.
Oh, Madonna.
Ooh,
Madonna. Definitely Madonna. Yeah. I'm trying to think of ones that like you felt like you were emotionally close to them.
Well, I mean, obviously for me, and I've talked about on the show before, Hulk Hogan. I mean, like him losing the title on February 5th, 1988, I wailed. It was really like a family member being shot in my presence.
It's like you're like running to the TV.
No, I was running out of my mother's bedroom to like go into my bed and just like, he lost the title. And I was 11.
That seems kind of old for that kind of behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah, you admit it. You admit it.
But he lost the title. I mean, come on. There's, you know, he didn't lose the title much. And it shocked me. And just because he was my hero and my hero lost, it elicited an emotional response.
Sure it did. That's fine. Nothing wrong with that. It's just kind of funny. Just kind of funny.
And that is one thing I do like about professional wrestling. Is that it does, at its best, kind of know how to tiptoe around the parasocial relationship thing as well, because these people are trying to initiate that. Even though, obviously, we're not talking, they're not giving you permission to, like, show up at their house or anything like that, but they want you to care. And, you know, the best ones are able to do that and everything. But, you know, from there, like, musicians, like, for a while, I had a Bowie period, you know, to where I would, like, read any interview I could from him just to hear what he was reading. Because he was always reading something interesting.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, like, there was one book from author Elaine Pagels, P-A-G-E-L-S, and I know I'm mispronouncing it, but it was a history of how Satan came about, through, you know, but she's a historian, so it was, like, talking about how, you know, the creation of the Bible, the idea of Satan came to be.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and that was thanks to David Bowie.
Yeah.
Ultimately, yeah, like, have you ever felt in a have you ever encountered a celebrity or somebody that you've had a parasocial relationship with, and do you recall how that went?
I definitely have met people that I idolized. One such occasion was meeting Ward Churchill. Ever heard of Ward Churchill? He was a scholar in the 90s.
Not Winston's grandchild?
No.
Okay.
In the 80s and 90s, he was a scholar, an academic, and he was also a member of the American Indian Movement. He was there at Wounded Knee, and he had then been a academic, and he wrote a book, and it became a bestseller. And then he went on tours, and I saw him perform. Read from his book. And he was so mean. Like, I understand now, but like, as a 19-year-old who thought that this thinker was the way I wanted to be able to think like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was just so discouraging that anything anybody like me could do. So it was disappointing to meet him. Like, I wanted him to be inspiring, and yeah, he really wasn't. And then I remember, like, somebody asking him, what can I do? And he was just like, nothing.
I mean, sometimes it's not fun meeting your heroes. Like, I remember an old boss of mine initially gushed about how she got to meet Yul Brynner once, you know, but then ended up not liking the guy because, like, he gave an attitude to, like, a group of sick kids that came to a show to see him. Like, he wouldn't come out and, like, shake their hands or something, like, afterwards or something like that.
Really?
Yeah, so I mean, I can understand that. Like, I haven't really interacted with too many celebrities in person or online. I mean, I've talked about the time I annoyed Pete Townsend.
Yeah.
Even though he said, you know, I wasn't the cause of it, the subject that I brought up, Mr. Michael Moore, was, and that I understand. Brian Michael Bendis, when I worked at the Apple store, he was actually one of my customers there. and you're like nodding your head and you don't know who he is, but he's writes for Marvel Comics. He's the guy who created Miles Morales, the new Spider-Man.
So did you say, hey, I like your work?
Well, I made sure to do my entire job first.
Uh-huh.
And then once the transaction was done, then I was like a 14-year-old, you know, seeing like a boy band member, like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, you Gamora Spider-Man. And so thank you for that. Oh my God, oh my God. You know, type of thing. I mean, it wasn't that hyperbolic, but it was essentially something he'd heard before. And thankfully, Brian Bendis is a very nice guy. Like, one story I've told on the show before was watching a Q&A he did at a Comic-Con in town in 2017. And the first person who came up asked her a question, and he answered. And he goes, and by the way, come get your drone. He gave gifts to the people that asked him questions. And we're talking real expensive gifts. And, you know, he is also the guy who wrote the first post-credit scene in a Marvel movie.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, that's like my personal interaction. You know, there are other celebrities that I've seen.
So how did he act?
He knew I was a little starstruck, but I think he also appreciated the fact that I kept it professional until the very end. I didn't start off by like, oh my God, you're so super awesome. Mm-hmm. And talking about his career when he just wants his phone fixed.
Right.
You know, and at the end of the day, I think that's a good attitude to have in terms of how to deal with them, because at the Portland store there were a number of times where you'd have celebrities come in, like Jonathan Frakes, Commander William Riker from Star Trek Next Generation came in.
Yeah.
Carlos Santana came in.
Wow.
NBA great Bill Walton came into the store. There were a number of famous people that would just out of nowhere just be there.
Because they happened to be in Portland and needed their shit fixed.
Yeah, and I think the thing with a parasocial relationship is, at the end of the day, acknowledge it's there. If you do get a legitimate chance to be able to have an actual conversation with a person, whether you're talking the 5 seconds at a Comic-Con where they're signing an autograph and you say thank you for everything, or if you bump into them on the street and they have a 20-minute conversation with you and take pictures.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, acknowledge the fact that you have this relationship with someone who has no obligation to return those feelings for you in any way, shape, or form.
Well, no, nobody has an obligation to return your feelings. But
obviously, yeah. But it's much more important to understand that because of something like celebrity crushes. I've had plenty of celebrity crushes over the years. And with as many times as I mentioned Scarlett Johansson on the show, let's let that dirty little secret out of the bag. But on the flip side, you know, like if I like went to like Scarlett Johansson's like social media and like, you're hot, or sending her letters or approaching her on the street, that would be a fucking stupid dick, disrespectful move. I have more play than at anyone else. Hey, baby.
Yeah, you're a super player.
Exactly. All over the place anyway. It's interesting to finally have a name to it.
Yeah.
And it does kind of, in a way, with the whole, you know, as we've talked about on the show before, Name Entertainment, it does kind of, now that I know what the name parasocial relationship, it I think it can be good for reflection's sake to be able to think, you know, is what I'm thinking about this celebrity, this writer, this person healthy or not? Because, you know, as we mentioned, it can go the negative side, and we're not, you know, going to go too in depth at all on the negative side, but I think it is important, you know, especially if you're going through stuff like depression or something like that. Maybe you use escapism as a way to get out of a depressive state, and, you know, getting too hyper-focused on a celebrity at that particular point would not be healthy at all.
I've definitely had it with, you know, I don't know how much this is parasocial, but I think that it is, because online relationships that never go beyond online relationships are to some extent parasocial, in that they're not interacting in your milieu. Like, they're not socially connected to you.
I get what you're saying, and I generally agree.
It's just something different about the relationship.
Exactly. Now, obviously, with an online thing, depending on where you meet, you know, you're still speaking to another person, but it's much different than meeting someone in real life and, you know, going from there.
Yes. For some reason, my experience with online, you know, getting close to people online, and I don't mean romantically, but just having friends that I just met online through playing a game, mostly, I would talk to them for hours and hours and hours. And that was good, but at the same time, it wasn't all that good. Like, it's better to be outside and be with people that can hug you. And
I would counter with this, and I think you will agree, it's kind of like, you know, the realization I came when I left Apple. Mm. You know, you can't have all your eggs in one basket. You know, you do have to have, when it comes to a social life, you do have to have those people you can be cool with chatting with online, but you have to have those people that it'll be, you know, you're going to meet up with every once in a while to go out on the town and have some fun.
Yeah.
Exactly. So we just bring this up here. I mean, I bring it up because, you know, as a writer, it's fun learning new words, right? And with this word, it opened the door to some pretty interesting talk. And like I said, just keep it in mind, folks, because you don't want to find yourself getting too hung up on someone you will never, ever meet, because then you will end up with pie in your face. I'm living proof.
Mm-hmm. Actual pie.
Exactly.
In your actual face.
Indeed. Indeed. Couple for the drinking game, folks. Any other words of wisdom for our friends at home?
No, just, you know, watch out for yourselves. Look out for parking cones. Clowns.
Yeah. Parking clowns. Oh, my goodness. I'm a parking clown. That would be, I mean, I would buy a car just to park at the parking clown parking lot, you know, where like it's like valet, but they're all clowns.
But they're all clowns. Nice to meet you. The clown valet. You know, the clowns can provide any service as a clown, right? It could be the clown housekeeper or the clown.
Well, just imagine the clown like pulling the scarves out, and then at the end of the scarf is your parking ticket.
Yeah, this is really funny.
That would, and yeah, and yet I'm here poor, and Elon Musk can bankrupt a company like Twitter and be given government bailouts at the end of the fucking day. Fuck that guy. All right.
With that,
each Monday, we'll have something in this podcast space to entertain your ear holes. Until we meet again, we bid you adieu.
Farewell.
Now and then, folks. Now and then.
Subscribe to Friend Stalking Nerding on iTunes, the Google Play Music Store, as well as Spotify. Remember to support Friend Stalking Nerdy on Patreon. Goodbye, darling.